This is Emory University Sound Science, conversations on transforming health and healing. Coming up on Emory University Sound Science, David Schulman discusses sleep, how it affects our health, and why people seek treatment for sleep-related difficulties. Schulman is the medical director of Emory Sleep Center. David Schulman.
The Sleep Center here at Emory is a multidisciplinary group of individuals consisting of neurologists, gerontologists, and pulmonologists. We also interface with otolaryngologists, the oromaxillofacial group, which is a grunt of surgeons, OMF, and we have a dentist who works with our group. It's a large group of individuals who are interested in advancing sleep health and well-being.
Schulman says he most often treats insomnia, but two other complaints are quite common as well.
Overwhelmingly, it is I'm tired all the time, or I can't ever sleep.
And while an occasional restless night is unpleasant, a chronic lack of sleep can affect one's long-term health.
Certainly, there are a number of disorders of sleep that seem to increase the risk of the development of hypertension, sleep apnea being the most well-documented. People with sleep apnea seem to be at a higher risk of developing hypertension, stroke, dyslipidemia, and heart disease. People with restless leg syndrome seem to be at least a double risk of hypertension. Sleep disorders as a whole are not good for you. And they make you feel cruddy.
What's more, a lack of sleep affects performance, whether it's at work, at home, or during the commute.
A lot of people are out there fooling themselves, saying, I get by on 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And they can get by, but they're not functioning well. Sleeplessness is like drunkenness. If you're chronically alcoholic, you lose the ability to detect it. I'm fine to drive. And the same is true of people who are chronically fatigued. People who are chronically fatigued often suffer from a misconception that they're performing optimally, when studies would show that they are not.
Schulman and his colleagues start treatment by looking for the underlying cause of a symptom or complaint.
We tend to look at the acuity. Has it been just short-term, is it long-term? Is there a specific precipitating event that may have set it off? Is there an underlying problem with depression or anxiety, which occurs in about, if you look at the literature, about 40% of the cases? And then, assuming we can't identify anything in particular, we'll often talk about behavior. People often throw around the term sleep hygiene. They love to say it. They love to say they're engaging in it, but I don't think most people know what it is.
So what is sleep hygiene?
So sleep hygiene is creating an environment that's conducive to sleep and demonstrating behaviors that are conducive to sleep. If you don't have a problem with insomnia, I don't think you necessarily need to police yourself too closely for sleep hygiene. But if you do have problems with insomnia, you've got to be very rigorous about it. So the strict rules that people love to violate are: bed is for two things, sleep and sex. If you're watching TV or reading, you need to not be in bed. If you're not falling asleep, you should not stay in bed for more than 30 minutes or so.
In fact, the harder you concentrate on trying to fall asleep, the more stressful it becomes, and the more likely it is to lead to psychophysiological insomnia.
Psychophysiologic insomnia is literally the stress you're putting on yourself because you can't sleep, making it harder for you to fall asleep. It's the fact that your body has become so accustomed to this difficulty, you expect it every night, and it's self-fulfilling. It's like a bad version of biofeedback.
And then there's caffeine.
Caffeine lasts in your body for 12 hours. You know, if you don't have insomnia, I don't care if you have caffeine with dinner. But if you have insomnia, no caffeine after noon.
None.
Smoking, alcohol are also no-nos. Alcohol, a lot of people use alcohol to help them fall asleep. It can actually help you fall asleep, but at 3 or 4 hours later, it'll wake you up.
Although medications to aid sleep are commonly used and prescribed, Schulman is concerned about the use of drugs to treat sleeplessness.
I personally, and I openly concede, am very against the use of hypnotic medication other than on an as-needed basis. Most of these medications are not approved for long-term use. I'm very averse to them. And so these are agents that I would call hypnotic agents, things that you take with the intention of helping you try to fall asleep at night. They're a tool of convenience and often used when one does not want to deal with the underlying problem.
Schulman and his colleagues are now set to study sleep apnea and its treatment.
So sleep apnea is a problem where breathing cuts down or cuts out for short periods of time at night, often interrupting sleep. Most common symptom of sleep apnea is fatigue, but there is evidence, as I hinted a little while ago, that severe forms of sleep apnea seem to increase the risk of high blood pressure and heart disease. We know that severe apnea is really, really bad for you, but is mild apnea bad for you? Is moderate apnea bad for you? And one of the studies that we've been involved in here has been looking at these forms with people with mild sleep apnea to see who should we be treating.
And napping? What about napping?
Wonderful. What about it? It's profoundly protective. Studies show that napping for 30 minutes in one study improves your performance for 4 hours after that nap.
I'm Robin Tricolis, and this is Emory University's Sound Science.